Let's do it this way. Let me start by just taking maybe three or four general comments, thoughts, reflections from the floor, and then we'll try to work a little more systematically. Any thoughts? Yeah, please. Just do we try to speak a little louder?
Oh, sorry. Even though the prophet seems to blame Ahab for all this, it's really the wife who's a real bad guy. I mean, Ahab just says, you know, he's not how he'd like the land, and then Jezebel is the one who actually does the framing.
Okay, so I want to come back to this question. But I want to at least mention that I think one of the things that is going on in this text is a kind of meditation on the guilt of people who quietly go along with what other people do that's horrible. Meaning, that's actually why I called this session What Happens When a Greedy King and Not When a Greedy Queen Kills an Innocent Peasant and Incurs the Wrath of God. Because I think one of the things that's going on in this text is the moment when Jezebel tells Ahab he's dead, and Ahab just says, okay, I'm going to go down and get it now, right? And I think, as we'll see when we go more systematically, there is something in this text about the attempt of people to wash their hands from what they actually know they're guilty of. We'll talk about this, I think, at some length. Yeah, Vincent. And then, yeah.
So something which starts out as Ahab's idea is this idea of turning part of Israel into the Gan Yakar.
Gan Yarak.
Yarak, sorry. And I'm just a little curious about what that means. So turning part of Israel into something Egyptian.
Would you have said that without seeing that I put a few psukim from Zarim at the end?
Obviously not.
Not, okay. Yes, I want to come back to that. I want to come back to that. Meaning the term Gan Yarak, just to sort of preview this, appears twice in Tanakh. Once in this story, and once in Devarim's description of Egypt. And I think it might be interesting as a cue. Not sure. Yeah? Just speak up a drop, if you don't mind.
Ahab almost has a tantrum. He's so big. It seems to me that maybe part of it is that here he kings, and one of his subjects is not giving him what he wants. And usually when a king tells you he needs something, you really want it out of him. This guy is not so polite either. He's a better one.
Good. I think that there's a lot going on in this text here about Ahab's passivity and Jezebel's activity. And there's also, as you probably noticed, some really kind of fascinating gender politics between them, right? Ata atata semlucha. Now you'll be a king. How? I'll give it to you, you pathetic excuse for a king. Right? I think that's very clearly going on in this text, right? I mean, ata atata semlucha. You will now show how to be a king. How? I'll give it to you. Now, that may go to your point. I mean, clearly, Jezebel is being constructed here as a very villainous character. We'll come back to that. But it's actually striking, in a way, how Ahab's first response is not only not violent, it's, if anything, I don't even know what to say. He just capitulates and, you know, lies in bed and won't get up. It's actually fascinating. I mean, this is way beyond what I think we can do in the short time that we have. It's also fascinating in this chapter, the way everything revolves around eating and not eating as a kind of a literary device here. I don't exactly know what to do with that. But, yes, last comment for now.
Verse 27, I don't see that quite as passive as what you do when you're repenting. Everybody who repents puts on sackcloth, rubs himself in ashes, stops eating, and sits down. I mean, it's the sort of thing you do. It's not like, okay, well, I'm going to go. I read it as, wait a second, I will repent.
No, that's at the very end.
Right.
You're jumping all the way to the end. I'm talking about what happens after Jezebel dispenses, after Jezebel dispenses with Navot. At the very end, yes. I think at the very end, what you have is like a really interesting, I would call this almost what you have is a junior Jonah moment at the end of this text, where basically he repents, and God, in contrast to Eliyahu, is actually willing to imagine a place for mercy. I mean, Eliyahu has this fascinating role in general, where he seems angrier on behalf of God than God. In this chapter and in general. So we'll come back to your point, but that's a different moment in the progression. Now, okay, let's just zoom out for a minute. So one of the scholarly debates, modern academic scholarly debates about this chapter, I think is actually very interesting. According to one reading of this text, what you have here, among other things, is a deep systemic conflict about how to view land. That in one understanding, This is Navot, is the kind of paradigm or the paradigm of this understanding. You have the notion that land is heritage, and land and owner are inextricably bound up with one another. And on the other side, you have this notion associated with Izebel and Ahav, really with Ahav, land as commodity. Now, that is an argument that has been advanced, for example, by a contemporary Bible scholar named Walter Brueggemann, that essentially he tries to argue that one of the contrasts between the worship of the God of Israel on the one hand and the worship of Baal on the other is economic. Right? Now, it's maybe worth saying Brueggemann clearly has a contemporary lefty project. Right? That doesn't make him wrong, by the way. It's important to say what drives some of his readings. And the desire to critique the spiritual impact of an economy that is entirely and exclusively market-driven, right? That's one of the things that Brueggemann does a lot with Tanakh. But his argument here is not crazy, I think, for the following reason, which is, otherwise, it's sort of hard to understand what it is that Ahav does wrong at first, if anything, right? He basically approaches Navot and says, I'll tell you what, I really value what you have. I'll trade you or I'll pay you. And Navot's response is really interesting, right? Chalilali, God forbid that I give you my father's nachala, right? That is not land as commodity. That's land as inheritance. So it's like there's some deep systemic moment in conflict here where Ahav, Navot appears to be saying to Ahav, I don't understand the request, right? I just don't understand. Why would we operate like that? This is my father's land. So much in Chumash, for example, is predicated on the notion that, you know, even after I sell land because I've become poor, I ultimately go back to it. There is some connection between, you know, a person and the home from which he or she comes. Now, just to sort of, you know, make this fair, other Bible scholars, more conservative, small c, right, basically say, come on, we just don't know enough about, you know, what a Baalist approach to economics is. You're reading a lot into this one chapter. I don't know what to do with that. I do think the reading is not crazy here. And one other thing I would say that may be going on here, I really don't know if this is an overreading, but the fact that Ahav says, I want it as a gan yarak, and that gan yarak is a term that is used only to describe Egypt, I just wonder whether that is the text's quiet way of making sure we realize that the request is on some level problematic. Because what is Egypt, if not, in the Bible, the culture that sees no problem with exploitation? Yeah, I don't know. I can't prove this. You know, one of the problems is, you know, this is, I've said this in this space many times, one of the problems with literary readings of Tanakh is that there are simply no controls. Right? So the fact that a phrase appears twice in Tanakh, is what I should learn from that? That the two places are talking to each other, or that this phrase appears in two places in Tanakh? No, I mean, like, it's a very serious question. I don't know how to answer that, right? I think it's at least suggestive, but I don't think it's like knocked down, like, oh, obviously they're talking to each other. They may very well be talking to each other. Now, to take this one step further, right? So we said level one, is there a conflict here about how to approach land? But level two, which is perhaps the most obvious level, is the, I think, dramatic theological claim being made in this text, which is simply that God will not tolerate exploitation of the weak by the powerful in general and by royalty in particular. Because just think about this text for a minute, right? And then apply it as a critique to any civilization in the history of the world, right? That is, when a king and a queen dispense with one person who gets in their way, that is enough to mean the destruction of the entire kingdom, more or less for all time. That is a pretty, like, explosive claim. And that's the claim of this text, it seems, right? It's basically saying, oh, did you think it's no big deal after all? Who is that? Wait a second. Let me tell you who that is. And then God shows up. And by the way, the literary structure here is amazing. You read the first 16 verses, and you think it's a great story about a king and a queen who can get away with anything. There's no indication that anything is going to go wrong. And then out of the blue, it's like this amazing scene where, like, you know, this rocket shows up and God comes out and says, I'm sorry, what? Right? I mean, it's literally, it's actually quite moving because the story is set up, right? They totally get away with it. And then all of a sudden, right, God says, Eliyahu, you busy? I'm about to wreak total havoc. Because what? Because one innocent person was just exploited by a king. Just a sort of side note to this, I think it's interesting to at least mention, you know, one of the things that is, one of the weird legacies of Jewish liturgy is that because we find ourselves praying for the restoration of a Davidic monarchy three times a day, it is easy to think that you can make the following sentence. Tanakh is in favor of monarchy. Except most of Tanakh finds monarchy terrifying, both because it's theologically violates its notion that God alone is sovereign, famously Gidon, but also because, right, kings exploit. Sof pasuk, right? That's also, kings exploit. They exploit their power. They will rob you dry. And here you have a moment where this is just right out there on the table, right? Ahav is like the biblical king nightmare, right? That's what he is, right? Essentially like, oh, you're in my way, you're done. So here it's like a very dramatic, I think, theological claim. Now, to draw this out literarily, I think it's important to pay attention here to the word, to the shoresh, nun taf nun, the word notain, right? Ahav asks Navot to notain him his vineyard. Navot says, God forbid that I notain you my vineyard. And then what does Izebel do? Ani etain, right? I will give. In other words, she says, her vision of rulership is amazing. Ata ata ta'aseh melucha. You will now be king over Israel. You will show them what it means to be a king. And what does it mean to be a king? Nobody gets in your way. That's what she says, right? You will now be king. How? I'll give this to you. And what you have here, I think, is this very striking, right, claim, the presumptuous claim. I can't, if he won't notain, I will notain. And then what happens from verse 17 on is God basically shows up and says, wait a minute, right? And by the way, God does it in an amazing way. Subtlety here is beautiful. Where does God tell Eliyahu to go? Where? What does God say? Go talk to Ahav. Where is he? He is in Kerem Navot, right? Text very clearly says, God says, oh, did you think that your pathetic, corrupt, political land grab here has any status at all? Let me tell you what that place is. That place is Kerem Navot. You could scream until you're blue in the face. You could kill everyone here. That place is not yours. You can't notain what's not yours. That's the basic kind of theological critique of unchecked royal power, right? That's going on in this text in a very dramatic way, right? The working definition of governing here is not exactly a paradigm to look up to, right? Basically, right, what does it mean to be king? You can do what you want. Now, we don't have the time to do this in a complicated way, but as I'm standing here, I'm realizing it's also an amazing contrast to probably the biblical text that is most focused on what an ideal king looks like, which is Psalm 72, right? Where it's very clear, right? What does the Solomonic king behave like? The paradigm of being a king is being completely preoccupied with the well-being of your most vulnerable subjects. That is the role of a king. And conversely, those of you who want to look this up, Ezekiel 34, God fires the kings of Israel because they're so corrupt that they actually think the poor exist for their benefit rather than them existing for the benefit of the poor. And God says, you know what? You're done. I'm in charge now. Now, it doesn't go that well either, which is one of the theological challenges of the text, right? But I think that there's something here about a vision of the sheer corruption of the monarchy and the attempt to establish God as the radical antithesis to that possibility. Now, there's a couple of things here that I want to mention that are very subtle, that I think make this text much more interesting than just what we just said. One is that I imagine that the parallel here between the story of Ahav and Izebel on the one hand and the story of David and Uriah on the other is intended. That is, I will simply write a letter after which the person will be gone. And write the same thing. Right? I'm going to send a letter that will dispense with our enemies. And I suspect that one of the things that's going on here is this very subtle attack on those who think that they can simply say, me? I was sitting in an office all day. I never killed anyone in my life. What do you want? I mean, literally, I was sitting here signing pieces of paper. How could you accuse me of anything untoward? I mean, I didn't do anything. It was a bunch of scoundrels from some city who killed them. I didn't do anything. And the attempt to pull in Ahav and Izebel, all the excuses don't work, right? You simply think you can just like write a letter and poof, your enemies are destroyed. God is watching. That continues, I think, in two really amazing ways that I want to make sure we see, and then stop and take a round of comments. Look for a minute, let's look at this together, at verses 11 to 13. Okay, Yud Aleph to Yud Gimel. So, in verse 10, Izebel had sent out a letter saying, find some scoundrels to accuse him of cursing God. V'hotzi'u v'siklu v'yamot. Take him out, stone him, and let him die. And then we follow that with the elders and the nobles do just that. And at the end of verse 13, Vayiskiluhu va'avanim vayamot, right? They stone him and he dies. And then, amazingly, this is all about reading slowly, the opposite of what I said. Vayishlechu Elizebel lemor sukal navot vayamot. All of a sudden, note the shift to the passive language. They write a letter to Izebel and they say, Navot has been stoned. Not, we stoned him. Right? The sheer abdication of responsibility. In the language of American political discourse, mistakes were made, but no one actually made them. Right? Mistakes were made. Lahavdil, right here, Sukal Navot. He's been stoned. Oh, who stoned him? He's been stoned. But no one will say, we stoned him. Right? That is like classic political discourse, right? Classic, right? He's dead. What do you mean he's dead? Right? Eliyahu shows up, what do you mean he's dead? You killed him. Don't think that the passive voice exonerates you morally. It does not. And it's worse than that. And I want to take this one step further, and then we'll take a round of comments. It's worse than that. Because what happens? What is the means that they use to set him up? They declare a fast, and they accuse him of having cursed God. Now, what's interesting is the use of fasting suggests that there is some kind of religious crisis here. And the accusation that what he's guilty of is actually a religious crime. This, I suspect, is Melachim's attempt to say, you know, in case you don't spend a lot of time thinking about how religion can be little more than a tool for the powerful that deepens their corruption with impunity, here's a story for you. Yeah, what did he do? He cursed God. And you know, we're so pious that we fasted the whole day to figure out what to do about that before he was killed, which no one did, right? And there's something here that's actually very powerful, like, oh, like, and if prophetic literature is about anything, right, it's about how impossibly corrupt religion is, right? I hope that doesn't, like, shock anybody, but, like, that's what prophetic literature is about. That's actually one of the things I think is so interesting about Tanakh, is that fully a third of it spends its time telling us how bankrupt we all are, basically, right? I mean, more or less. And here, right, it's like these two moves. One is the shift into the passive voice, and the other is a sort of invocation of, oh yeah, how do we get rid of people? We invoke religious language. What do you mean? It's a sacred duty. He cursed God. And the attempt to point to the depth of corruption and the way the powerful can use anything to further their own ends, I think is very much what's being kind of thrown at us right here in this text. Okay, let me stop and take a few questions or comments before we try to dig even deeper in this text. Yeah,
so it seems like the narrative here that, okay, you have a corrupt king and queen and they use their power and ways to corrupt the people, but it's also the narrative that they use their power in ways that are immoral. But it kind of seems to suggest that this story is saying that the only way to counter that is by God intervening. There's no sense of what the people are doing and how they're trying to counter this power dynamic. And you don't even
Yeah, it's like a really interesting question. I don't exactly know how to answer that. I do think that it may be the case. I was like, how's that for a hedge? I do think that it may be the case, but I'm really not sure. That part of what's going on here is also an admission of why it's so terrifying to have a monarch. That on some level it may require divine intervention to overturn the sheer kind of heartless brutality of all this. I don't know. I mean, if you ask certain Jewish thinkers, they would say, look, you know, what happens over the course of Tanakh, and then certainly later, is that God begins to pull back and human responsibility becomes greater. I don't know. I don't know really how to answer that. I think it's an interesting question. Yes, please.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Suggests to me, if I read something by Elkanah Samet, my teacher's chapter, that maybe the people themselves were a little less corrupt than the king was. Like, they had to walk through the process of finding, yes, religion can be corrupted. We need to find, we can't just, you know, knock the guy out. But we're going to go through the channel, and we're going to describe in great detail every step in which people were involved.
You know, I love what he's trying to do there, but when the text says in verse 11, "Vayasu anshei iro haskenim v'achurim asher yoshvim biro kasher shalchai leim izevel kasher katuv basfarim," sounds a lot like they did exactly what they were told.
Correct.
So, you know, I would want to see a little bit more. Well, she says Hoshivu Anashim Bnei Vlial, which implies that they know, right?
Is that the content of the letters, or is that
set up the scoundrels? I think so. I don't know.
What the letters
say. Oh, I assume that the context of the letters is essentially verse 9 and 10, right? That's what they're being asked to do. I am sympathetic to what Samet wants to do, but I don't know. I would want to see more to make that seem to me to be a plausible reading. I mean, I haven't read his piece on this, but I... Lichora, let's put it this way. On first reading, I don't really see it. But again, I'm happy to... If you have it available, send it to me. I'd love to see it. Yeah?
If Ahab is so nefarious, then why is he given a pass? And if he's given a pass, why is the retribution then...
Yeah, so I want to get there. I think that's very hard. I'm not sure that he's given a pass. I think it seems to me that one of the things that goes on in the literature of Nevuah is an extreme preoccupation with saying that the word of God of condemnation is never final, even in the most egregious crimes. That's why I wasn't kidding when I said this is a Junior Jonah moment. I think you have a little bit here of even Ahav, right? Even Ahav, God has a moment of saying, oh, he seems actually like, someone said this before, he actually seems genuinely penitent. Let me, right? Let me actually soften this. Now, the question of how that works with, okay, I won't kill him, I'll kill his children, is a complicated issue. I mean, I can imagine, I think what Chazal would do, which is say, oh, the assumption is those children will also be corrupt. But I don't know. No, it's that piece, I think, is a good question. But as to what's going on with God softening, and I actually think also that that's part of the, this is something I hope to have some more to say about down the road, but something about the relationship between God and Eliyahu is about that. That Eliyahu is, you know, more zealous for God than God. And Tanakh, I think, is pretty clear that that's problematic. You have that, you know, in the famous scene, right? Two chapters earlier, the Kanokineti scene, right? I alone, I am the only one left. I am the only serious person about this covenant. The last one, right? And then amazingly, like what happens? You know, Izevel, this is Perek Yotet, Izevel tries to kill Eliyahu. And what does Eliyahu say? Ki azvu britcha b'nei Yisrael, your people have abandoned your covenant, et mizbechotecha harasu, but Nevi'echa hargu v'charev, right? They destroyed your altars. They killed all your prophets. Va'ivatera nilavadi, right? I'm the only one left. Vayivakshu et nafshi lekachta. The antecedent is all of Israel. They're all trying to kill me. Did you just say that all of Israel is Izebel? Did you in God's just basically say, are you nuts? Right? And basically what happens in that chapter, God says, maybe you should appoint a replacement. No, seriously, what's God saying? You know what? I'm a little scared of you. No, I think you really have that in this story, right? The question of whether Pinchas is too zealous in Bamidbar is a hard question. But whether Eliyahu is too zealous in Melachim Aleph, I don't think it's so hard. I think Melachim Aleph is perfectly comfortable drawing that out. Eliyahu is kind of terrifying to it. By the way, I have never seen a source for this. If anyone knows a source for this, you should please tell me. But there is an old thing that you hear about why is Eliyahu forced to be at every Brit Milah. People familiar with this? Eliyahu sits at every Brit Milah because anybody who says Ki Azvu Britcha B'nei Israel is forced to sit and watch every Jewish boy be brought into the covenant. It's basically God's punishment of Eliyahu. Right? I'm sorry, what did you say? All of them? You're the only one? Okay, there's a lot going on with Eliyahu. Now, okay. One more step here. And this is here about literary readings of Tanakh. And I want to mention this to you because this is an interesting example of where you can just have a moment to have empathy for anyone who tries to translate anything from one language into another. Right? And it's about sound in a way that I think you basically automatically lose when you try to go from one language to another. And it is incredibly subtle. The power struggle between God and Eliyahu on the one side and Izebel and Ahav on the other is encapsulated in the following contrast of sounds. What essentially happens? Navot is dispensed with, and Izebel says, Kumresh, go down and inherit. Right? And then, what does God show up and say to Eliyahu? Kumresh, go down to that place, and you tell them what I think about this. And what you essentially have is, right, in sound form, the battle of Kumresh and Kumresh, which is the battle of evil versus good, which is the battle of Baal versus God, which is the battle of absolute limitless power and the forces of decency that combat. I don't think sounds like that are so accidental. I'll give you another great example of this. I think I've spoken about this in this space before. I think the best case of this is in Shmot Perek Aleph, right? How does Shmot tell us that God is lined up on the side of life and Paro is lined up on the side of death? What does Paro say? Let's oppress them, pen your bet, right? Lest he multiply. And then, subtly alluding to God, what does Shmot Aleph then say? V'chasher yanu oto, ken yirbe. Right? Pen yirbe, that's Paro, that's the side of death. Lest he multiply. Ken yirbe, that's the side of God. That's the victory of life over the forces of death. Right? The battle of God and Paro in Shmot Aleph is the battle of pen yirbe versus ken yirbe. You can't do anything about it. You know, not even Everett Fox can do that. You can't do that. It's too hard. You can't do that. Actually, you'll be curious to see what he does, if anybody wants to look. Right? I say that because Everett Fox is, like, all about sound. Right? This is a moment where, you know, Martin Buber and Franz Rosenzweig famously said the Bible is meant to be heard, not read. This is a great example that they should have given. Right? Kumresh, Kumresh, you'll never notice that. You're just kind of reading. But if you hear it, it's amazing. Right? It's this kind of, like, dramatic opposition, the forces of good against the forces of evil. Now, I want to maybe just say one other thing, and then again take another round of comments or thoughts. I think it's also worth noting here that, you know, I think it's fair to say, tell me if you agree with this, that the battle of the prophets versus two things, immorality and idolatry, which seem to them to be totally intertwined. And you probably could even say that some prophets sort of dilate, emphasize immorality, and also talk about idolatry, and some prophets emphasize idolatry and also talk about immorality. I think what's interesting here, Amos would be a great example of being basically focused on immorality, right? Idolatry is not a major trope in that book. Here, you have a prophet who is famous for his war on idolatry. And yet, what is this like incredibly dramatic moment about? You know, when the rich and the powerful simply think they can run roughshod over the weak and the innocent, God will go bananas. And I, Eliyahu, will go even more bananas. Which, again, I think is really interesting. And I think it's actually very, you know, this notion that those two things are totally intertwined, idolatry and immorality, in the eyes of these prophets. And even the great warrior on idolatry basically wants to say, what is the great manifestation of idolatry in Israel? Look at this. Look at this. The notion that the powerful think they can do whatever they want with no implications or consequences. That's idolatry for you. Now, okay? Now, I've said many times, I hope I don't offend anyone by saying this, if you were trying to write a history of Canaanite religion, I would not suggest that you do it based on reading Tanakh's presentation of Baal. Meaning, obviously, there's a dramatic polemic going on here, right? But I think the point is like very dramatic and important, which is how intertwined those categories are from the Torah's perspective. Okay, let me stop, take one more round, and then I want to just say a couple of closing things. Yeah, please.
So I have a question. You were mentioning how there's great criticism of monarchy as terrible, potentially, kind of regime. And yet we see that in the end, the only person who's reprimanded and actually gets the chance to repent is Ahab. If we're trying to say that monarchy is something terrible, why don't we just go straight to the people, the scoundrels, for example, or the people who committed this whole thing, and have them repent or punish them? Why do we go through Ahab, after all, and give them a chance to, go back and say I'm sorry?
Yeah, I think it's a hard question. I mean, I think one of the things that goes on in Tanakh, I don't have this worked out at all, is that once the people choose melucha, they're a little bit forced to deal with it. Once the people choose monarchy, they're forced to deal with it. I don't really know the answer to your question. I mean, I think it's interesting. It feels like this text, this parak, is more interested in the consequences for the people with the power than it is in a systemic question of what would the ideal power structure be. I don't think this is one of Tanakh's reflections, and I don't know if this is what I'm saying is right, but it doesn't strike me that this is the chapter we're going to turn to for, let's have an abstract reflection on whether monarchy is inherently evil or not. It's actually about, given a system, right, what is God's role in it? I'm not sure I buy what I just said either. So your expression, I'm on your side. I'm not sure. I don't know the answer. Yeah, please.
I'm just questioning.
In fact, don't buy what I just said.
I'm just questioning one of the last things you said about when this happens, the nation or the king or whomever is going towards idolatry. And it seems to me that at that point, that king and the people who follow him are going into pathology.
Yes.
Not necessarily idolatry.
Okay, yes, except, in the Bible's, let's say, less than generous perspective on idolatry, right? Idolatry and pathology, or idolatry and, I don't know, pathology, I mean, I would actually, I would use a less clinical word. I would say, wanton immorality.
Well, if we look at the main evil people in the world, they're crazy. They're not necessarily
idolatry. So here is a conversation that in the 6 minutes that I have left, I would rather try to avoid. The question of what the relationship is between moral language and psychological language, which is, could take us basically the rest of our life trying to unpack. I think this is probably one of the messiest philosophical questions we have about language of illness versus language of moral responsibility. It's very complicated. Very complicated. It's like a morass in my view, right? Now, but
I just don't know that these people are idolaters.
Well, okay.
I know that
you don't know it because the text hasn't said it yet. And yet, you mean that the Israelites who follow Jezebel's word? Because we know that Ahab and Jezebel are idolaters. We certainly know that Jezebel is an idolater. Again, I think that we should be careful here about not too easily collapsing the distance between us and this text. Meaning, I think this text simply assumes that there is some intrinsic link between the worship of Baal and the moral corruption. If you want to call it pathology, we can call it pathology in this context. It's fine. Now, whether we might say, wait a second, but I've seen people behave this badly without any connection to idolatry. Sure, but this text is concerned with, worse yet, You might say, I've seen people behave this badly, you know, while being good, quote-unquote, monotheists, right? Yes, I mean, that's what prophets do for a living. That's, in a way, why I think some of the later prophets are even more explosive than Eliyahu. For Eliyahu to come and say, you worship Baal, you're horrible, it's like, you know, think about someone else who says, oh, you're Miyahu. You know, you're here in the temple. You know what you can do with this temple? I'm not going to finish that sentence, but I'll tell you what you can do with this temple, right? Or Yeshayahu, right? I mean, Yeshayahu is amazing. That is, to me, you know, if we weren't so busy domesticating Torah, as we all do, right? You know, the moment of the Haftarah on Yom Kippur should, like, basically make every one of us scream in terror, right? Seriously, the notion that you've basically been in shul for about 16 hours now, and then, like, you know, the liturgy basically says, oh, by the way, did you realize this whole day is entirely worthless? I mean, it's so dramatic. And yet, like, oh, yes, that person has such a nice voice, the way she chants the Haftarah, right? No, it's, like, very, right? It's very easy to domesticate this stuff. But the stuff is, this is explosive. This chapter is intended to be like a stick of dynamite. And, you know, we tamp it down all the time. Now, I want to make one more point before I run out of time, okay? And it's actually, it's two quick points. One is that I think it's worth at least noticing in this perek that what God says and what Eliyahu says are not the same thing, right? God articulates a punishment, and Eliyahu, you know, if I may quote a great philosopher, turns it up to 11. Right? Eliyahu amps this up in the most dramatic way, right? He turns this up in the most, you know, and now, you know, one of Abraham Joshua Heschel's most famous lines, and I don't think he was thinking about this, right? The prophet is not a microphone, right? The prophet's personality has a role. Now, I'm not sure that he meant that when God gets angry and articulates a punishment, right, Eliyahu comes along and says, that's not enough. That's not enough, right? Let me tell you what a punishment looks like, God. Right? Let me show you. But I do think that it's interesting for thinking about what a biblical approach to prophecy would look like, that Eliyahu really is not a mouthpiece in this chapter. He is very much interpreting and expanding what he hears from God. There's something very significant about that. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's extremely interesting. Right? You have moments in the other extreme. Right? Probably the single most in my current obsession, trying to figure out Bamidbar Chaf Hei. Right? Where Baal Peor, God says, right, hang them all! Right? It's not the most easy to read moment. I think it's Pasuk Gimel, Dalet. God says, you know, hang all the leaders of the people. Or the JPS translation, no one knows exactly what this means. Impale them. And what does Moshe do in the next pasuk? How about killing the people who did this? He doesn't even say to God, the way he often does, really, are you sure? He just ignores what God said. It's amazing. It's a crazy moment. There's a moment where Moshe functions, by the way, and then comes Pinchas. We could spend 3 years on that parak. It's so complicated. But what I'm pointing to that as an example of the other extreme, where God says something, Moshe does not repeat it. Moshe, I don't know what to say, interprets, softens, dilutes, holds God up to a standard he believes he's learned elsewhere. I don't know. It's very strange. This is Eliyahu doing the opposite, right? God says, here's a punishment. Eliyahu says, you call that a punishment. Watch this. Right? It's very, very interesting, and it's just striking for thinking about, you know, the notion that revelation is a dictaphone. I like to call that the Yeshiva High School vision of Revelation, right? It's a dictaphone. You know, Kadosh Baruch Hu, like, pulled out a thing, right? And he talked. And then Moshe was, like, scribbling words down, right? Tanakh is a little more nuanced than Yeshiva High School. I'm not saying that dismissively. It's like high school theology, it is what it is. But it's not, I think, when you read these texts, they're more complicated. They're richer. Last thing about this that I want to at least mention that I think is another amazing kind of provocation or stick of dynamite, as it were, in this text. Pasuk Chaf Hei. Okay? Rak lo haya ke'achav asher hitmaker lasot hara v'ene Hashem asher esata oto izevel ishto There was no one who committed himself to do evil, as goaded by his wife, Izebel, v'yeta'ev me'od, and he behaved horribly, l'alechet acharei ha'gilulim, to follow the drek. That's what gilulim is. Just talked about this today with a couple of students. The word gilul philologically means, I'm sorry to say this, gilulim means balls of dung. It's the Bible's word for an idol. To go after this garbage, this stuff, kechol asher asu ha'emori, like the Amorites did. I think that thing is very important. By the way, JPS here does a subtle piece of biblical criticism. You'll notice the parentheses, which is its way of asserting that this is a later interpolation. It's a later interpretation. Do with that what you will. But what I think is interesting is the Amorites. Why are the Amorites important here? Because what does God say to Abraham when he creates a breed with him? I will not give your children the land of Israel yet. Key what? Because the sin of the Amorites is not yet bad enough, right? Avon ha'emori. It's not bad enough that I can kick them out yet. I'm not going to kick them out. Now I'm going to say something totally anachronistic and bizarre. That is Bereshit's attempt to wrestle with Devarim. What do you mean? You're just going to kick them all out? Or murder the king? Well, wait a second, says Bereshit. Let me just make something clear. These people are monsters. Now, I'm not saying here to defend. I just want to say, like, in other words, there's a struggle here with how can it be that the Amorites are kicked out? Well, they're not going to be kicked out until they've earned it. What I suspect the narrator in this parable is doing is basically saying, did you think, this is classic prophetic mode, do you think that the Amorites were held to a moral standard and you have a tour? You're immune? Do you see what I just did to Ahav? Do you see what Eliyahu just said to Izebel? Yeah, I kicked them out because they're horrible. I'll kick you out just the same way. I'll destroy an entire kingdom if you exploit one person because you think it's okay for the powerful to do that. This, in other words, I think is like a mirror of Amos's, you know, probably most explosive pasuk in Nevi'im in many ways, right? Etchem yadati mikol ha'amim. You do I love among all the peoples of the earth. Al-Kain, right? Et kod alechem et kol chatotechem. Right? The ultimate, quote-unquote, anti-triumphalist vision of chosenness. I love you more than anyone else. Therefore what? Therefore every last thing you do, I will hold you to account for. That is not triumphalist theology. That is terrifying. Right? And I think here, like, the narrator is doing something similar here and basically saying, wait a second. Yeah. Right? You followed Arkea and Mori in this way? You'll go like they went. Because in the end, you know, you can't be in this land. That's a whole nother piece of biblical theology. This land physically will not tolerate you. Right? This whole notion of Bible, which I don't begin to understand yet, about actually the way that the land cannot tolerate innocent blood. Right? It is like a metaphysical reality. Maybe it's actually not a metaphysical reality, it's a physical reality. What?
It vomits out.
Yes, it vomits out. It's exactly, there's something about it that is I think metaphysical is actually too abstract. It is physically intolerable for the earth. By the way, think about, that's already kain behevel, right? Kol, listen, d'mei achicha tzoakim elai min adama, right? The blood in the earth is still making a claim. So, you know, I think it's actually fair to say the Bible is, the Torah is like completely obsessed with what happens when power, the illusion that power permits everything, is allowed to run wild. And it really understands, I think, the role of God's prophets is basically saying, what? Right? In no universe is that who the God of Israel is and what the God of Israel will tolerate. If we had more time, which we don't since we're out of time, I'll just say that I think a really interesting discussion that we could have sometime, that is fascinating, I've said versions of this up here before, is the question of just whether and how the rhetoric of prophecy should and should not be used in contemporary political discourse, which I think is an extremely vexed question. And most people in this country only think it's a horrible thing when people they disagree with use it. right? And it's a very complicated thing, right? So, you know, if the Christian right claims to know what God says, that's horrible. But when the Upper West Side claims to know what God thinks, that's, of course, correct. Now, I'm just saying, there's something very complicated about that. And there's something to me that's, you know, on the one hand, the prophets as paradigm are enormously important inspiration. On the other hand, it's very scary when people then end up describing their own politics as prophetic, as opposed to, like, aspiring to be in the world. I mean, right? But I'm not saying that to dilute the importance of this. On the contrary, I think trying to take the prophet seriously is fundamental, and we would all, let's say, be serving God more authentically if we did. But I think in knowing the difference between aspiring to live in the language of the prophets versus labeling ourselves prophetic is a really important thing to think about. If you label yourself prophetic, what are you saying about the people you disagree with? Not sure that makes for the healthiest discourse in the world. It's a very complicated question. I say that because I think it's a really important thing for us all to think about. I have no idea what the answer is, but to take these texts seriously, but to be careful about using them, ironically, to congratulate ourselves, which is what happens when we call our own politics prophetic. Thank you all very much.